I'm talking about bilinguals and language dominance. We all know that bilinguals, that migration leads to bilingualism. So that's a basic thing. So I have some figures about migration here, therefore. So migration, these are the most recent figures that I have. You see, we have about 600,000 immigrants to the UK in 2016. In Germany, you all know that, more than 1 million last year. So it's a global phenomenon. It's a European phenomenon. We have millions and millions of migrants in Europe. And many of these children are, these migrants are children, and also they get children. Children grow up in majority that has a different language, and we call these people heritage speakers here. That's a term that is used in the recent years in linguistics. So these are children growing up in an environment that has a different language than their home language, and they develop this heritage language. So in Germany, for example, Turkish. And if you say, people say they are halbsprachig, one thing is, of course, their Turkish is different from the Turkish that they speak in Turkey. And the longer this history goes on, let's say in 2 years, two generations or three generations, this Turkish will develop its own variety. But there's not a deficit. I mean, English is not, has not a deficit with, because the Anglo-Saxons brought their German to England and they developed English there. It's not a language that is, has a deficit against German or so. Now, the theoretical background on research, my research and many other researchers in bilingualism. So I will talk about the so-called common underlying proficiency. Cummins goes back to Jim Cummins. The so-called threshold hypothesis also goes back to Jim Cummins. The notions of Bix and Kalb, so basic interpersonal communicative skills and cognitive academic language proficiency. I will talk about briefly about the notion of basic language ability and higher language ability, goes back to Hilstein, Jan Hilstein. And we'll talk about the so-called bilingual vocabulary gap and the idea of a total conceptual vocabulary. So that is the common underlying proficiency, which means that the two languages of a bilingual are linked together. And there is something that underlies the proficiency in both languages. They are not separate. So competence in L1 depends in part on competence in L2. The other way around, competence in L2 depends on L1. Related to that, and Janine was quite critical already about this, is the threshold hypothesis. So at the first level, we have a lower level in both languages, and this is the famous, infamous semilingualism. Then the idea, if you reach a certain level in both languages, everything is fine. And if you go higher, if you become a balanced bilingual, you have cognitive advantages. Now, I show this here for historical reasons. This goes back to the 70s. Nobody believes in a balanced bilingual anymore. Janine explained that clearly. But the idea that certain levels of bilingualism are related to some cognitive advantages or disadvantages are still alive. There is criticism about the threshold hypothesis. It's very difficult to operationalize. When is somebody balanced? When is somebody better in one language? How to compare this? And as we know, bilinguals that are balanced hardly exist in reality. Then also going back to Cummins is this Bix and Kalb distinction, where children in a migration setting develop these basic skills quite quickly. At some point, they are indistinguishable from the other children. So people think, all right, everything is fine. Teachers think everything is fine. But what they're lacking is this cognitive academic proficiency, which takes much longer to develop. Some people say 7 years, some people say 10 years of migration. So there is this situation where you have children in a class that are seemingly proficient in, say, German, but if they have to write an essay, they can't. because they are still lacking of this kalp. But this is, according to Cummins, only because it takes much longer to develop kalp, and it's quite 2 years or so if you develop BICS. So you have children that are fluent, have no accent, so are native speakers, but kalp is underdeveloped because it just takes longer. Then Jan Hulstein, this was a theory, comes from education. Jan Hulstein talks about it more in linguistic terms. He talks about basic language ability and higher language ability. Basic language ability is something you learn automatically as a native speaker, no effort. But higher language ability you only learn at school. It's more complex. Related to that is the question, is there a bilingual advantage or disadvantage? Cognitive advantage or disadvantage? Is it a good thing to be bilingual or not? Diaz and Klinger, they were one of the first who say it is positive to be bilingual. They have advantages in conception forming, classification, creativity, and so on. And that's italics added by me, in visual spatial skills. So their cognitive ability in a non-linguistic area in spatial skills is higher than that of monolinguals. Kroll and Bialystok also said that bilinguals' non-verbal cognitive processing is something very surprising. Pub and Greenberg said, we don't have enough evidence. So it's still under discussion. Is there a bilingual advantage or is it not? And that is the question that I have in study one. This study was carried out by my PhD student, or together with my PhD student, Sarah Ongun. She investigated 100 Turkish English bilingual children in the UK, and also questionnaires from the parents and the background. We have these research questions. How is the vocabulary in both languages related? Common underlying proficiency, perhaps. How does vocabulary develop with regard to BICS and KALP? Is there a bilingual gap? Do they have a smaller vocabulary than their counterparts? Is vocabulary related to intelligence? And what influence does parental support have for L1, for the first language, on the development of the children? So we have 100 children, their parents. Important to notice that they are all from middle-class background. At least one parent has a university degree. The Turkish migration to the UK is completely different from the Turkish migration to Germany. And the middle-class people doing business there or going to university. We have receptive vocabulary tests, so-called XLEX, I will explain that, in both languages. That's also very important that we measure both languages. We have productive vocabulary tests in both languages. We had animals, colors, body parts, and food in both languages. Then we have a language dominance scale. This is a questionnaire that asks parents about their dominance, either for Turkish or English. And we have a language social background questionnaire. What languages do you use when? So that's what we have. It looks like this. Children have to say, if you read it to them, or if they read it, but in this case we just read it to them, which words do you know? Of course, they are tempted to cheat and say yes to everything. Therefore, there are some non-words in there, non-existing words, and if they say yes to these words, then they will be marked down. In fact, they get 50 points for each word that they know, and 200 points minus if you say to a non-word, I know that. Now, I tell you the word that I thought was an English word. It is not. It is Kennard. Sounds English. There is a town called Kennard, but it is a name. It's not a word in the language. And this format is easy to develop if you have frequency lists, and therefore you can also develop it in any language you want. So then we had this fluency tasks, colors, body parts, and so on. And they were carried out separately in English and Turkish. And then we had this non-verbal intelligent task called Raven's Progressive Matrices, designed for children, and you have some patterns that you need to identify. And then we had this dominance questions, that's for the parents. So basically it asks in different domains, what do you prefer to use, English or Turkish? Which language would you give up if you would have to give up one language, and so on. And they get a score in that. And then we have hypothesis one. Is there a relationship? Or the hypothesis, there's a strong correlation between scores in Turkish and English in XLEX. That means in the receptive vocabulary. So the idea is children with larger vocabularies in Turkish have also larger vocabularies in English. And this is the case. You see the maximum score for both languages, that is Turkish, would be 5,000. It was 100 words, 50 points each. No non-word accepted means maximum score of 5,000. And also in Turkish, that's Turkish, that's English. And you see there is a clear correlation. The correlation is about 37, explains 37% of the variance. That means you can predict 37% of the vocabulary size in English if you know the vocabulary size in Turkish. The next suggestion idea was about Bix and Kalb. This is also receptive vocabulary size, but then over the months. This is age in months with children. So that these are 80 months old, which is 7 years. It goes up to 11 years. The black line here is Turkish, which goes up. And the dotted line here is English, which goes up as well. Of course, they develop. But the interesting point is here, when English takes over. Turkish still continues, but English takes over. And this is at an age of roughly 10 years. And that is perfectly in line with Jim Cummins' idea that it takes 10 years to develop Kalb in a migration setting. Here, this English here is Kalb. That is school language. This Turkish is still home language because they have no schooling in Turkish. It develops, that's positive. But this is school language, and that takes off. So we have a dominance change here at the age of roughly 10, where English takes over. It's a typical situation for a migration setting. What about the vocabulary gap? If you compare bilinguals with monolinguals, you will find that they have a lower vocabulary in L1 and a lower vocabulary in L2. That's the typical vocabulary gap. That's semilingualism, if you look at it in a critical way. And there it is. Here we have Turkish. This pointer, here. This is Turkish. This is a so-called box plot. It shows the spread of the scores. So the child with the lowest scores around 20 in these four fluency tasks has only 20 words in these four domains, so five in each. And the child with the best scores has about 80 in these four domains, so 20 each. And this is the monolingual Turkish children back in Turkey with a comparable background, and you see they score much higher. So the highest Turkish bilingual children are roughly at the middle value of the highest monolingual children. And nobody reaches the highest level of the monolinguals. And the lowest monolinguals here are still 75% above the others. And you have the same in English here. Mm-hmm. So there is a bilingual vocabulary gap. Now, if you look at the total conceptual vocabulary, the picture is quite different. You get this. These are the bilinguals here. Some of them are even better than the monolinguals. Some are poor compared. But overall, the difference is not significant. It's not statistically significant. There is no gap. There is no bilingual gap if you compute it in that way. So the bilingual gap is just an artifact of the methodology. What you also see here is that the spread in the bilinguals is larger than in the monolinguals, which means there are bilinguals who have that gap, but there are bilinguals who don't have that gap. You are even better than the others. And overall, if you look at it, there is no gap. We thought that the language dominance has an influence. So we had this dominance test where we have either more Turkish or more English dominance of the parents. In general, if the parents support L1, children have a larger dominance, a larger vocabulary. And of course, this might also lead to higher IQ scores. So we split up the Turkish children, 100 children, in two groups, one with higher parents with higher dominance and parents with lower dominance. And we find this. Of course, the children develop, their IQ gets up, like Google, over time. But the with lower dominant, Turkish dominant parents are always behind those children with higher dominant, Turkish dominant parents in their IQ scores. So speak Turkish to your children at home and they become intelligent. The effect is quite large from a statistical point of view, but you see that also with the just from the graph, there's always this difference. They don't touch each other, these curves. There's always a difference. So there is a strong positive correlation between parents' use of language at home as well. This was dominance, now it's language use. We also find correlations here, significant correlations. So if the parents are dominant in Turkish and if they use Turkish more at home, children have a larger vocabulary in both languages and have higher nonverbal IQ scores. So what we found is, hypothesis one was supported, that vocabulary scores in both languages go together. Hypothesis two, that kelp develops slower than Bix, also was supported. But there is no bilingual vocabulary gap if we take total conceptual vocabulary into account. And with regard to IQ scores, vocabulary knowledge and IQ scores are related. It's stronger for receptive than for productive vocabulary. There is a bilingual advantage for nonverbal IQ scores when we take the dominance of the parents into account. Language dominance of the parents has an effect on children. They have higher vocabulary and higher IQ scores. And also the home language, which language they use at home, is important. The threshold hypothesis perhaps needs to be revised in that we don't talk about balanced bilinguals and upper and lower threshold. Perhaps we replace that with the idea of parental support and vocabulary knowledge. But there are limitations in this study, and these are quite important. These are all parents from a middle-class background. Whether that can be replicated in another context is a question. So there is a bilingual advantage. There's no bilingual advantage per se. Bilingualism is a challenge. We have larger spread of scores, larger standard deviations. But with parental support for L1, and that doesn't only be parental, could be support at school, we can get a bilingual advantage, we can get larger vocabularies, we can get even higher nonverbal cognition scores. And as a result, of course, research on bilinguals has to take that into account, has to, the complex picture that is there. We cannot just take bilinguals and then do some research with them. We really need to look at the background of that group. Educational and political decisions have to be based on that, on support for L1. The threshold hypothesis is a valid framework, but it needs to be redefined. Any questions?